today is Spinoza. I wanted to start with a bit of an advertisement for a friend of mine, whose name is David Quigley. American, but that shouldn't be held against him. And he's giving a class in the second semester that is called Spinoza Lesen. It's a course specifically about Spinoza, and it's actually specifically about different interpretations of Spinoza, focusing on French interpretations of Spinoza, which, of course, Deleuze gives one of the more important ones, but Deleuze's interpretation of Spinoza is only one French interpretation, and in fact it is an interpretation which is in many ways based upon slightly earlier interpretations of Spinoza by other French philosophers. So I think if you're interested in Spinoza, you know, we only have one class about Spinoza here, and it's not really enough to get anything except for just a little taste of Spinoza. So if you find yourself interested in Spinoza and you want to find out more about it, then I really recommend David's class. It's in German, so maybe that will make it more attractive. Okay. So I want to start this week with a quotation that comes from Nietzsche. It's the first quotation on the sheet I've given out. I'll just start by reading it. This doesn't come from one of Nietzsche's texts. It comes from a letter that he wrote to his good friend Franz Overbeck in 1881. He writes, 1881, if you're, yeah, okay. It's important, the date, but I won't go into it. He writes, "I'm absolutely astonished and quite enraptured." It's not an unusual state for Nietzsche, of course. "I have a precursor, and what a herald he is. I was practically ignorant of Spinoza. That I am now hankering after him was the result of instinct. Not only is his overall objective, like mine, to raise knowledge to the mightiest effect, but in five of the main points of his doctrine, I find myself. The most abnormal and loneliest of thinkers is closest to me, especially in these things." Okay, so these are the five main points. "He denies freedom of will, purposes, a moral world order, whatever is non-egoistic, and evil. Of course, the differences also are tremendous, but they lie more in the difference of age, culture, and science. In summa, my solitude, which, as on very high mountains, often, very often, has caused me to be short of breath and the oozing of blood, has at least for the time being become the isolation of two. Strange." Now, there is quite some debate within Nietzsche studies as to exactly what of Spinoza Nietzsche read. Some people seem to think he didn't actually read any Spinoza. Just if you give it to people who come in late, thanks. Some people seem to think that Nietzsche didn't actually read Spinoza at all. He read a commentary about Spinoza that was written by a friend of his. But other people think maybe he read some passages from Spinoza that were included in with other things and so forth and so on. This, like many aspects of Nietzsche studies, is kind of the very esoteric end of philosophical speculation and not something I really want to talk about here. I think I mentioned last week that there's lots of discussion about what Nietzsche did or didn't read, because Nietzsche was such a strange philosopher, because he wasn't, you know, from a relatively young age, from his late 20s, he wasn't actually working inside a university or within, let's say, university networks. So, you know, he was a kind of a self-taught person after that time. So there's a lot of discussion about what he did and didn't know. But obviously he had come into some kind of contact with Spinoza, and he had, in a certain kind of way, recognized himself in Spinoza, or at least recognized a kind of a forerunner. Now, Deleuze is going to spend quite a lot of time, especially in this small book that he writes, Spinoza Practical Philosophy, it's called in English, which is a kind of an introduction to Spinoza, a bit similar to the book he writes on Kant. It's designed for students, school students, or let's say undergraduate university students, as a kind of a guide and introduction to Spinoza. But this, of course, doesn't stop Deleuze from making his own kind of reading of Spinoza, which will be just as singular as the reading he gives of other philosophers. I'm not going to talk too much today about the specifically Deleuzian nature of his reading of Spinoza. For those of you who have tried to read Spinoza, you'll know it's a very, very technical philosophy. And it's difficult to understand Deleuze's reading of Spinoza outside of this very kind of technical language. But for those of you who are interested, Deleuze's reading on Spinoza especially concentrates on the role of the attributes, and the way in which he emphasizes the role that the attributes play in making the modes and substance immanent, or immanent to each other. This is an element of Spinoza that is not generally emphasized. Spinoza is like, you know, it's like Kant or Plato or Hegel. It's like you can spend your whole life, you know, inside of this one single philosopher. There's an enormous amount of literature on Spinoza, and there are just as many different interpretations of Spinoza as there are of any other philosopher. So you can find, you know, analytical Spinozas. You can find, of course, you know, kind of communist political Spinozas, which is the famous Spinoza produced by the Italian Antonio Negri, and so forth and so on. So Spinoza is, you know, there is a Spinoza for every philosopher, and Deleuze's is just one. But if you're interested in going into more of the technical elements of Deleuze's reading, it's in the reading of the attributes that Deleuze produces his own kind of Spinoza. But what I really want to talk about today is more or less the way in which Deleuze reads Spinoza as being a kind of, let's say, very close to Nietzsche. Yeah, because this somehow makes more sense for us, having just come from Nietzsche. And then at the end, I'm going to try and talk a little bit about the way in which we can use Spinoza to think about aesthetics, which is not exactly obvious because Spinoza himself never speaks about art, at least as far as I'm aware. So that'll be what we do today. Now, Deleuze is going to focus on three aspects of these five points of conjunction that Nietzsche identifies between himself and Spinoza. Deleuze is going to say that Spinoza and Nietzsche share three enemies, yeah? And these enemies are consciousness, values, and what he calls sad passions. We'll find out more about what these might be as we go along. And Deleuze says that it's exactly with the denunciation of these three enemies. The denunciation of these three enemies form the basis of what Deleuze calls the grand identity Spinoza Nietzsche. Yeah? This is Deleuze's words, the grand identity Spinoza Nietzsche. All right, so the first one, the first shared enemy of Nietzsche and Spinoza, and I guess we can say fairly confidently this is also an enemy of Deleuze's, of course, it's another kind of ventriloquism. The first one is consciousness. More specifically, Deleuze says, in both Nietzsche and Spinoza, there is a devaluation of consciousness in favour of thought. Okay, this might seem a little bit strange at first to think, okay, so we're devaluing consciousness in favour of thought, but what's the difference between consciousness and thought? Okay, well, we'll try and work that out now. The first thing to remember is that basically Deleuze is going to place this devaluation of consciousness that he finds in Spinoza against the philosophical tradition of rationalism, which is the idea that there is the mind and there is the body and that the mind has priority and, let's say, causes the body to act. Yeah? So this would be, in many ways, what's become the kind of common sense way of thinking about the relationship between the mind and the body. That we think something and then we, through our thought, through our conscious thought, we cause ourselves to act. But really, Spinoza wants to try and dissolve this causal link between the mind and the body. And he comes at this very, very old philosophical problem of the mind and the body, the relationship between them. He comes at this problem from a quite unusual and new angle. Spinoza argues that the body escapes consciousness inasmuch as, this is the second quotation on the page now, it escapes consciousness inasmuch as, quote, no one has yet determined what the body can do. That is, experience has not yet taught anyone what the body can do from the laws of nature alone, insofar as nature is only considered to be corporeal, and what the body can do only if it is determined by the mind. This notation afterwards is the standard notation for giving quotations from the Ethics, which is the main source for Deleuze. It means the Ethics, Book 3, there are five books in the Ethics, Book 3, Proposition 2, yeah, and Scholium, which is a kind of addition to the proposition which comes at the end, which sort of explains it. All right. So, Deleuze calls this a declaration of ignorance. And he says that this declaration of ignorance is both a provocation, but he also says that it is the war cry of Spinozism. That this is the crucial element by which Spinoza, if you like, wages war against the dominant philosophical traditions, or at least the tradition of rationalism. But actually, it's a provocation towards both a materialism that would understand the body as being determined by the laws of nature, as well as a provocation to rationalism, which would see the body determined by the mind. Because, according to Spinoza, neither of these ways of understanding the body tells us what the body can actually do. As a result, thought escapes consciousness through the body. It's precisely because we don't know what the body can do that thought goes beyond consciousness. Okay, how does that happen? It happens because, and this is what is the strange kind of development that Spinoza makes, is that for Spinoza there is no causal relation between the mind and the body. The mind and the body, he says, are two different attributes that operate parallel to each other but without connection. This means that what is an action or a passion in the mind is an action or a passion in the body as well. They don't cause each other, but that for every, let's say, feeling that we have in our body, there is an idea in the mind. They exist in parallel, yeah? But they do not have any causal connection. Spinoza puts it like this. This is the next quotation. The mind and the body are one and the same thing, which is conceived now under the attribute of thought, now under the attribute of extension. The result is that the order or connection of things is one, whether nature is conceived under this attribute or that. Hence, the order of actions and passions of our body is by nature at one with the order of actions and passions of the mind. So, when Spinoza says we don't know what a body can do, he means that the body goes beyond the knowledge we have of it, and so the mind necessarily goes beyond consciousness. So if we don't know what the body can do, if the body can do things that we don't know, then it means that as we find out what a body can do, we will also find out what we have not yet been able to think. Yeah? Because there is this parallelism between the mind and the body. So if it's possible for the body to do something new, to have a new experience, yeah, then it is possible, or it is necessary in fact, for us to have a new thought. This means to discover new feelings will mean to have new thoughts. And this is already a direct connection to questions that we've been thinking about in relationship to aesthetics, because we remember coming from Kant, for Deleuze, art is the realm of sensation, the realm of feeling, that if an artwork can create a new feeling, then it can necessarily create a new thought. And in effect, Deleuze will always remain consistent in this, that art is a way of thinking in the same way as philosophy is a way of thinking. Yeah? In relationship to Nietzsche, with a slightly more political angle, we can also say new feelings, or that if art creates new feelings, it creates new thoughts. New thoughts are new possibilities for life. Yeah? We don't know what the body is capable of. The thing that allows this parallel research into what lies beyond consciousness, according to Spinoza, is that the mind and body behave according to the same laws of nature. So this is somehow necessary for Spinoza, that there must be the same laws of nature operating in the physical world as there is in the mental world, otherwise it would be hard to understand how there were what this parallel relationship could possibly exist. These laws are first of all a physics that doesn't begin from what bodies are, but from their relations to each other and what these relations produce. Now, this is another very consistent factor in Deleuze's philosophy from his first book on Hume, that philosophy is not a question of discovering what is, it's a question of discovering the relations that exist between things, that what things are is basically their relationship to other things. And this really finds a very important reference in Spinoza. Spinoza calls the relationship between two bodies an affect with an A, not with an E. So there's a difference between an effect, which is like cause and effect, and an affect, which is a feeling, something that you feel when you are affected by another body. Yeah, you come into a relationship with another body, and for Spinoza, this causes an affect. Now, affects can have there are two types of affect. When a body encounters another body, they sometimes combine to form a more powerful whole, and sometimes one decomposes the other to destroy its cohesion. So this would be a kind of a positive and a negative affect. A positive affect means that I join together with the body that I come into contact with, and together we form a new, more powerful body, or the other body, or perhaps one body anyway, overcomes, if you like, the other body and destroys it. Yeah? Now, for every one of these physical encounters between bodies, there is a parallel encounter of ideas in the mind. Yeah? It's the parallelism. As Deleuze explains, this is from the small book on Spinoza, the order of causes is therefore an order of composition and decomposition of relations, which infinitely affects all of nature. Now, this again is the kind of Spinozian version of what I talked about last week in terms of forces and the will to power. So if you think an affect is the result of an action by one body on another, but that relation, that action, yeah, has itself been caused by another relation of a body on a body, yeah, and so on, 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 encompassing the entirety of nature. This is, you know, a constant fact in the philosophers that Deleuze look at. This is precisely what he's interested in, because he always wants to see how the particular and the universal are in fact the same thing, that any actual singular event or body is an expression of, let's say, the entirety of the universe which contains it. You know? So this is also a very important aspect of Spinoza's philosophy. So it means that nature is an infinite causal network without beginning or end. But consciously, we don't experience life like that. Consciously, we only experience the effects of these causes. So, in other words, we experience joy when we enter into composition with another body and our power increases, and we experience sadness when another body decomposes our own. These are Spinoza's terms, joy and sadness. But whether joy or sadness, these effects give only what Spinoza calls an inadequate understanding of the bodies that act on us and the bodies we act upon and all the other compositions and decompositions, not to mention their rules, that make up the living plane of nature. This is what Spinoza calls the first form of knowledge, inadequate understanding. And it's inadequate because consciousness imagines that it is the real cause of affects when it isn't. Inadequate knowledge is, in this sense, the result of an egotistical understanding that always wants to make itself the cause. In this sense, consciousness takes effects for causes, imagining, for example, the feeling of pain as the cause of my scream, without understanding that the pain is itself caused by something else acting upon me. This would be an example of the way that I make myself the cause, whereas in actual fact, what I understand to be the cause, which is the pain I feel, is only an effect of something else that acts upon me, and so on, and so on, and so on. So, in this way, consciousness invokes itself as first cause, claiming the power of free will over the body. So, this idea of free will is precisely an idea by which I understand myself as free to act, that I don't act because I'm determined by an effect or by something that affects me from outside, but that I have within myself the freedom to act as I want. Yeah? Now this is going to be something again that both Nietzsche and Spinoza are going to reject very strongly. So in terms of this idea of free will, willing to do something is seen as a cause of action. And when we assume free will, no further explanatory cause is required. Finally, when consciousness cannot explain effects according to itself as first cause, it invokes God as a theological first cause, a kind of meta-consciousness, a kind of guarantee of our own freedom. It's effectively what Kant does, actually, although we didn't really talk about that. Now, Spinoza doesn't reject consciousness, but he rejects these efforts by consciousness to understand itself as cause of itself. For Spinoza, consciousness, like everything else, is composed and decomposed through relations with exterior things. Consciousness is therefore an effect and not a cause. It is only an inadequate understanding of relations between my body and other bodies, my mind and other ideas, which gives me an awareness of the affects these relations provoke. There is nevertheless something internal to me that, along with my relations to external objects, acts as a cause of consciousness, and that is desire, for Spinoza. It's a very important term. And for Spinoza, there is not free will, but there is desire. And desire is the desire to persevere in my being, Spinoza says. So it means that, you know, it's not just, everything is not just a kind of a totally random collision of marbles on a table without any kind of consistency or purpose. Yeah? That each individual is animated by a desire to preserve themselves, yeah? To persevere in their being, Spinoza says. So this is a kind of biological desire to life, yeah, that is obviously very difficult for Spinoza to deny, because we only need to look in a very cursory way at the natural world to see that living beings tend to try to protect themselves, to prevent their own destruction. And Spinoza acknowledges that and calls that desire. Because I desire to continue living and to increase my power of doing so, I desire those relations that increase my power and desire to avoid relations that decrease my power. Spinoza argues that the affect proper to relations of composition of increasing power is joy. These relations increase my power to act. And the affect that is proper to my to a body's decomposition, to the decrease in a body's power to act, is sadness. Consciousness therefore experiences joy and sadness, that is, I experience the increase of my power or the decrease of my power, but this understanding remains inadequate to what is really going on in these relations, because I'm simply understanding the effect and not the cause. That's why the understanding is inadequate. It's exactly this infinite chain of causal relation that my consciousness is unable to understand, is unable to grasp. And it is precisely the function of reason, and particularly the function of philosophy, that increases our ability to understand the world in the way that it really is, to understand the world in terms of what my body is capable of doing, of what my body is capable of experiencing, and of relations that constitute the world and express the world that go beyond, let's say, my own individual consciousness, my own individual egotistical perspective. Alright, so that's consciousness. The second common denunciation between Nietzsche and Spinoza, Deleuze says, is values. For both Spinoza and Nietzsche, there is, or both of them undertake, a devaluation of all values, inasmuch as these are shown to be effects and not causes of action. This is going to lead, again in both, to a practical reversal of the principle by which morality operates. A principle by which consciousness is able to dominate the passions. In Nietzsche and in Spinoza, what decreases our power to live is not morally condemned as evil, but understood as a bad encounter that leads to our decomposition. As Nietzsche puts it, it's a very famous quotation from Genealogy of Morals, beyond good and evil, at least this does not mean beyond good and bad. This means that even though, to follow the Nietzschean example, even though the Christian morality tells us thou shalt not kill, Nietzsche says that this is in effect a morality of the lambs that try to protect themselves from the wolf by morally condemning its act as being evil. But of course, the point is that it's only evil from their perspective, right? Because they're being killed. And so, in other words, it's an entirely relative morality, and that is then imposed upon everybody else. The point is that it's bad for the lambs when the wolf kills them, but it's not evil. Yeah? So, beyond good and evil, it's not beyond good and bad. The point is just that the fact that the wolf kills the lambs is not, it's only, to understand it as being evil is simply a moral perspective that is an effect of consciousness. That consciousness makes this moral valuation as a way of trying to protect itself. Spinoza, like Nietzsche, sees moral values as false perspectives imposed by the inadequate understanding of consciousness. Against these values, Spinoza places more practical criteria. Something is good when it increases our power to act, and something is bad when it decreases this power. It's a very practical criteria. The good is therefore, Spinoza says, something that agrees with our nature, and the bad, something is bad if it does not agree with our nature. A good person strives to organize their encounters so as to join with what increases their power, and the bad person is one, Spinoza says, who lives haphazardly and who complains when things go against them and decreases their power. The bad person destroys themselves through guilt and destroys others through resentment. Such people, this is a quotation from Deleuze and it applies, of course, to everybody. These people live, Deleuze says, by spreading their powerlessness and their own enslavement to everybody. Here, again, this is Deleuze, ethics, which is to say a typology of immanent modes of existence, replaces morality, which always refers existence to transcendent values. So it means ethics always concerns actual relations. It always concerns this relation. Is this relation good? Does it increase my power? Or is this relation bad? Does it decrease my power? Morality, on the other hand, erects a transcendent value by which all possible action can be evaluated as being good or evil. So, for example, thou shalt not kill. To kill is evil. It's irrespective of the actual event. It's a transcendent value that determines any possible action. So this is the difference between what Deleuze calls a typology of immanent modes of existence. It means a typology or an assessment of any given actual event, as opposed to an abstract and transcendent value which judges, of course judgment is very important for morality, that judges any possible action. So for this and for other reasons, it's not surprising that Spinoza was excommunicated from the Jewish Church. Actually, not so much for that, but also because of his views on God, but I'll come to that. But the book that Deleuze mostly analyses, The Ethics, actually Spinoza never published it in his own lifetime because he thought that he would actually be putting himself at risk by doing this, that there was the possibility that he could be at the least imprisoned and at the worst executed because of the kind of radical nature of these ideas. All right, the third element that Nietzsche and Spinoza share is this denunciation of sad passions. Now, Spinoza's ethics will everywhere favour joy over sadness. And this, again, is very similar to Nietzsche. Spinoza condemns the man with sad passions, the man who exploits his bad affects on others to establish his power, and the man who is saddened by the human condition. These are, Deleuze says, the slave, the tyrant, and the priest, in Nietzsche's terms. These are also objects of Nietzsche's hatred. So the man with sad passions, that is the man who is always being badly affected by other people, whose power is always being taken away from him, he is the slave. The man who exploits his bad effects on others, that is the man who exploits his ability to take away others' power, he is the tyrant. And the man who is always sort of saddened in a moral sense by the state of the world and by the state of other people, that is the priest who wants to uphold the so-called good moral values. These three shared enemies of Nietzsche and Spinoza, as consciousness, moral values, and sad passions, are shared only to the extent that Nietzsche and Spinoza also have a lot of differences, of course. The most obvious difference, of course, is their style. Against the blinding poetic flashes of Nietzsche's aphorisms is the complex interweaving of Spinoza's geometric method. Against Nietzsche's love of intoxication is the cold precision of Spinoza's system. I'm just trying to think who it was. It may have been Foucault, I'm not sure, maybe someone else knows, but there was anyway a very famous 20th century philosopher who said that you couldn't call yourself a philosopher if you hadn't gone through a stage of infatuation with Spinoza. So I don't know if that's true or not, but Spinoza is definitely a kind of philosopher's philosopher, if I can put it like that, because it's very, let's say, it takes a lot of concentration and stamina to really get enthusiastic about it. But once you can, I think it's really very amazing. It's certainly absolutely crucial for Deleuze, and I would say it's almost impossible, really, to understand Deleuze's ontology without understanding Spinoza's ethics, which is more or less the kind of groundwork for Deleuze's ontology. All right. Now, Spinoza has... there is this one element of Spinoza which is slightly problematic for Deleuze, but which he goes to great lengths to explain, especially in the large book on Spinoza that was written as Deleuze's kind of second thesis for his doctoral examination in 1967, 68. Somewhere around there. You might not be familiar with it, but in France, it's kind of, you know, much harder to get your PhD than it is in, I think, just about anywhere else in the world. And you have to write two theses. You have to write a kind of major thesis, which for Deleuze was difference in repetition. And then you have to write a kind of a minor thesis, which was Deleuze's very, very big book on Spinoza, which was at least as big as the book Difference in Repetition. Now, Deleuze had already written 3, 4, 5 books before he wrote these books, and it was only after writing these books that he was actually able to get his doctorate. So you can see that it's a kind of a different way of thinking about the PhD degree. Now, Spinoza says that that each individual body has what he calls a singular essence, which is composed of the unique relations establishing the individual's degree of power. This degree of power is defined as a capacity for being affected, meaning an individual is defined by the affections they are capable of experiencing. The affections that they are capable of experiencing. This is an individual's essence. Yeah? It doesn't mean that the individual does experience all of these affections. It just means that there is a kind of predetermined amount of affections that an individual is capable of experiencing. Now, in a way, we can think of this essential capacity as being, in terms of what we've already talked about, the transcendental conditions of experience. But these transcendental conditions are, as we saw with Deleuze's discussion of Kant and Nietzsche, inseparable from our actual experience. So the more we feel, the more of our capacity to be affected we explore and develop, the more we know. So again, experience and knowledge is directly related. Spinoza writes, this is the next quotation on the sheet, "In proportion as a body is more capable than others of doing many things at once, or being acted on in many ways at once, so its mind is more capable than others of perceiving many things at once." Right, these affections that we are capable of experiencing are of two types. There are actions, which are explained by the essence or power of the individual who experiences the affect, and there are passions, which are explained by something else, by another essence that exists in the world. So this, we can see this conforms to joy and sadness. So when I act from my own power, from my own essence, and this gives me joy. And when I have a passion, it's a certain kind of joy. We'll see about that in a second. When I have a passion, I'm acted upon. I'm acted upon by another body, another set of essential capacities. Now, when we are acted upon, we have passions. And these can be of two types. These can be joy or it can be sadness. So if I'm acted upon and my power to act increases, I experience joy. If I'm acted upon and my power to act decreases, I experience sadness. But the point about both of these passions, joy and sadness, is that they are not explained by my own essence, they are explained by something else. They merely express the action of something outside of us, upon us. So in a way, the passions are just an image of an external thing. The passions represent the action of something else upon us. The images of things, Spinoza writes, are affections of the human body whose ideas represent external bodies as present to us. Representation in this sense, and this is very consistent with Deleuze's own views on representation will therefore be inadequate for understanding our real conditions. When we act, however, we do so from our own power, and the affects this produces express our essence and are, Spinoza says, clear and distinct. The idea of a clear and distinct idea is a very important one for the history of rationalism, and especially at the time of Spinoza with Leibniz and of course also Descartes being very concerned for both of them this criteria of clear and distinct ideas is a criteria of truth. So Spinoza is going to kind of take this but twist it a bit and say that it's not a criteria for truth, a clear and distinct idea, it's a criteria of an action. It's a criteria by which I act from my own essence. But it's going to be a little bit more than that as well. This is what's going to be important for us. So reason, inasmuch as it seeks to move from confused to distinct ideas, this is typical understanding of reason, that reason tries to move. We remember with Kant too, there was this idea of empirical experience provides confused impressions, and then it was the task of reason to kind of understand these impressions and to make them clear, to find the truth in them. Well, Spinoza says something similar, but he says that we start with an inadequate understanding of our relation to things, and reason attempts to move to an adequate understanding, to a clear and distinct understanding of these relations. This means, for Spinoza, that the body must pass from passions to actions, that it must pass from being acted upon to acting itself. So again, the body and the mind are acting completely in parallel to each other, that it is through the actions of the body that the mind will come to clear and distinct ideas. Now, Spinoza is going to argue, and this is, I think, a very nice argument for philosophers, that reason is only going to achieve this through experiencing joy, that it's only through joy that we are going to come to clear and distinct ideas about our relationship to other things in the world. When we experience sadness, an external object causes a decrease in our power, while joy expresses an increase. Although joy is still caused by an external object rather than by our own power to act, that is, a joyful passion, this joy nevertheless reveals what is common between my own essence and the essence of the object which acts upon me, which causes my joy. And understanding this common notion, as Spinoza calls it, this common notion, it means I understand what is common between my own essence and the essence of the thing which has caused me joy. It's only joy that can enable me to understand this. And through this common notion, I'm able to form a clear and distinct or adequate idea of my own essence, as well as being able to join my body's power to another's and to thereby increase my power to act. As a result, Deleuze comments, I think it's very true, sadness makes no one intelligent. That's what Deleuze says. Sadness makes no one intelligent. It's very nice. What makes people intelligent, according to Spinoza and to Deleuze, and I think we could say also according to Nietzsche, is joy. And reason seeks joy as the mechanism by which it can gain an adequate understanding of the relations that constitute its world. Deleuze writes, "The ethics is necessarily an ethics of joy. Only joy is worthwhile. Joy remains, bringing us near to action and to the bliss of action." And acting according to and thereby understanding our essence and the way it allows connection to other bodies and ideas, Spinoza calls them modes, actually, that share this essence, I'm able to understand increasing amounts of the essential nature of everything that is, which is God for Spinoza. So, joy is a passion. Something acts upon me that increases my power to act. That causes me joy. But it is precisely an understanding that what enables this passion of joy, that what enables this increase in my power to act is the fact that there is something in my essence and something in this object that acts upon me's essence that is the same, that forms a common notion, that is a new level of understanding which allows me now to understand the cause and not simply the effect. It allows me to move from this inadequate understanding of the passion to an adequate understanding of, let's say, modal essence. That's what Spinoza calls it. Now, Spinoza is going to argue that all modal essences are reciprocally determined through their difference from each other. So that there is this immensity of nature, which Spinoza also calls God, which is constituted by this infinite number of modal essences, which are all in, let's say, a differential relation to each other. So when I am able to understand a common notion, it means that I have understood something about the essence of God. I have understood a certain essence of God. And the function of reason is to try to always increase both its power to act, but also its power to understand the essence of nature or God, of everything. Yeah? So for Spinoza, there is another stage of knowledge, which he calls the third kind of knowledge, that is beyond common notions. And this will be a kind of mystical knowledge where I understand myself in the same way that God understands itself. It means that there is a kind of, Spinoza is going to call it beatitude. It's a moment where my understanding of myself as a, in terms of my own essence, is going to encompass, yeah, the essential nature of everything that is, because my essence is determined in reciprocal determination with all other essences that constitute the entirety of nature. So that when I reach this final stage of reason, I'm going to understand how I myself am simply an expression of everything else that is. That when I think myself, that is God thinking him or herself. Yeah? So this is the kind of trajectory of reason, if you like, in Spinoza. And it's a kind of a, it has a distinctly mystical aspect, of course, because it involves the way in which it is possible for the understanding to have knowledge of everything that is. Yeah? This is the classical kind of mystical ambition. But it's going to be a strange kind of mysticism, because the knowledge of God is not going to be the knowledge that escapes the world, it's going to be a knowledge of the world. So Deleuze is going to say that in Spinoza we find this kind of what he calls it a mystical atheism. A mystical atheism. So it's a knowledge of God, but God is the world, so it's a knowledge of the world. It's not a knowledge of something outside of the world. So mysticism is not a process by which we try to leave the world. Mysticism is a process by which we try to become one with the world. This is a very interesting part of Deleuze's philosophy that has had a lot of discussion about it in recent years. There's been a recent book published in English by a guy called Peter Halwood that's called Gilles Deleuze Thought Out of This World. Out of This World. And Peter Halwood is a kind of a follower of Alain Badiou, who wrote his own book about Deleuze, of course, called The Clamour of Being. And this kind of Badiouian critique of Deleuze basically claims that Deleuze is a kind of, let's say, contemporary Platonist, because Deleuze is always seeking this kind of knowledge of the transcendental realm, yeah? This knowledge which would be, let's say, the condition of the world, but not itself the world. And it's not wrong, this reading of Deleuze. It's possible to find this in Deleuze if you wish, particularly if you only read what Deleuze writes on his own without Guattari. But nevertheless, it has its own agenda, this reading, which is to say that it's not really possible for any effective politics to occur within Deleuze, because there's a kind of inherent romanticism to his thought, which is always about, you know, this kind of mystical drive to get out of the world, to go out of this world. So the Badiouian reading is very loaded in this way, because it kind of places Deleuze in a certain point. And then, I think I mentioned this last week, and then it wants to say, okay, well, that's, we love Deleuze, and Deleuze is fantastic, and Deleuze is great, but, you know, there's this real problem with Deleuze, and in order to fix that, you need me, you know. So it's a kind of a loaded it's a kind of a loaded but very interesting reading that Baidu gives. I'll try and talk more about it at the end of the course when I come to Baidu. But it's just to say that, you know, this is kind of contemporary philosophy is continually kind of engaging with thought in a way which has all of its own agendas and is very kind of vibrant. And it's with Spinoza that I think you see, if you like, the point at which Deleuze's own thought goes furthest towards this kind of characterization. And it's precisely because of this question of the modal essences, which is very difficult to work back into a fully immanent system. And Deleuze is going to make numerous attempts to do this, not only in the very big book that he writes about Spinoza, but in Difference and Repetition, he's going to use Nietzsche to try and solve this problem that he sees in Spinoza. So basically he's going to say, well, the modes are fully immanent in substance and everything that is, but there remains a part of substance which is not fully immanent in the modes. And this is this part, this essence, this essential part, yeah? And he's going to try and use the notes of Nietzsche, to try and sort of dissolve this problem in Spinoza. And then the next book, or the book after next, that he's going to write with Guattari and Oedipus, is then going to return to Spinoza as being, let's say, cleansed of this problem and being a fully immanent concept. But perhaps we can talk more about that when we get to Deleuze and Guattari. All right. Okay, so as a result of this way in which reason approaches an understanding of totality, Deleuze is going to say essences form a total system, an actually infinite whole. So it's this infinity of essences as they are reciprocally determined by each other, which is going to allow reason or understanding to approach a conceptual understanding of all the entirety of nature or God. Okay, so when does joy teach us, or what does joy teach us and allow us to experience? For Spinoza, thought and action, mind and body, involve increases and decreases in power. And when we adequately understand our joy, or increase in power, we have understood an essential law of nature itself. So a modal essence, a law of nature, which applies not just to my own state of being, but to the bodies that I enter into relation with. This understanding accruing from common notions does not concern our consciousness, which insists on imagining itself as the cause of our actions, but instead reveals the way we are determined to act by our modal essence. In this sense, knowledge is never of ourselves, but rather of nature, of its essential powers and their patterns of relation. When I understand another body according to a common notion, I understand my essence as an essential part of nature, inasmuch as I share this essence with something else. This essence is necessarily active and in a relation with all other essences, constituting nature. In this sense, the sense of essences as being active powers or laws constituting nature, nature, according to Spinoza, is absolutely perfect. This is the next quotation on the sheet. Spinoza writes, "Nothing happens in nature which can be attributed to any defect in it. For nature is always the same, and its virtue and power of acting are everywhere one and the same. That is, the laws and rules of nature, according to which all things happen and change from one form to another, are always and everywhere the same. So the way of understanding the nature of anything, of whatever kind, must also be the same, namely, through the universal laws and rules of nature. I shall consider human actions and appetites just as if it were a question of lines, planes, and bodies." Now, what this means is that nature itself is always perfect. It means that nature itself, the laws of nature, are always the laws by which bodies are able to combine and increase their power to act. That sad passions are only a result of inadequate understandings. It's only our consciousness which understands an affect, a relation, as being bad, as being a diminution of power. Yeah? That's not nature. Nature is perfect. So nature... Deleuze explains it like this. He says, okay, so we're driving our car, you know, we have this bad accident, you know, our brain is completely smashed all over the windscreen, it's very ugly, you know. But actually, this is only, you know, a bad thing from our own point of view. From the point of view of nature, it's kind of like a very beautiful new composition. Yeah? So it's sadness and bad passions is just a kind of an inadequate way of understanding that comes from our own kind of egotistical consciousness. This is a very clear statement also of Spinoza's so-called atheism, as well as of his abstraction. This is abstraction, I mean this final sentence in the quotation, "I shall consider human actions and appetites just as if it were a question of lines, planes, and bodies." Yeah, just as if it was a question of these essential laws of nature. So it's totally abstract. There is no kind of psychological or sentimental value that Spinoza is placing, that Spinoza is, let's say, allowing into his analysis. He's simply analysing or trying to analyse these essential laws of nature which apply only to composition, which apply only to action, which apply only to perfection. Yeah? There is no sort of sentimentality in this. If you read the reading in the reader, you'll get a really good sense of this. You know, sometimes it can seem a little bit silly, but, you know, it's like, well, you know, if somebody hates someone that I love, then I hate that person. You know, it's like a geometry. It's like a perfect kind of logic of the sentiments. You know, it has an absolute kind of necessity that has no exceptions and has a kind of perfect logic. Yeah? Okay, so human actions are understood as being abstract movements that express nature. And in the sense that these can only be understood outside of human consciousness, these movements are inhuman. The constant thematic of Deleuze, of course. I say Spinoza's so-called atheism because, in fact, Spinoza qualifies nature in a very significant way by using a Latin formulation, Deus sive natura, which means nature or God. This is exactly what he got into trouble for and why he was excommunicated, because he said to say nature is to say the same thing as to say God, and to say God is the same thing as to say nature. So obviously the idea is God doesn't exist outside of the world. Yeah? God exists in and as the world. There is no supplemental dimension. There is no kind of, you know, there is no extra place outside of the world where God is. God is only in and as the world. And This was interpreted in the 17th century, and not only in the 17th century, as being atheism. In actual fact, there is a kind of a strange subplot in German idealism whereby almost any philosopher who wished to be successful had to condemn Spinoza exactly as being an atheist. Spinoza became this kind of bête noire who was had to be, you know, first and foremost rejected by any philosopher because of the danger of this sort of philosophical atheism, you know, this what Deleuze would call a philosophy of immanence. Yeah, this was precisely what had to be rejected. There had to be a space found in the end for God. Now, God nature exists only by being expressed in active affects, and in having active affects, we express and therefore come to know God nature. In other words, we will only come to know God nature through knowing what our bodies can do. And so we will only come to know God nature by expressing it in our own way. Having adequate ideas is the first step in this process. For adequate ideas show us what we have in common with other bodies, and through these common notions, we can come to know God nature in the way that God nature knows itself. This is a statement of Spinoza's philosophy of univocal being, or as it's sometimes also known, univocity. This is a very old tradition in philosophy concerning univocal being, which goes back at least to the medieval philosopher Duns Scotus. Univocal being means that being is said in the same way about all its instantiations, most importantly as it exists in us as particular active beings or modes, as well as in what we express, the entirety of God nature, or as Spinoza also calls it, substance. This univocity is a way of understanding immanence. It means that the totality of everything, God nature, the being of God nature or of substance, is exactly the same being as is found in its modes or expressions, that is, in us. So on the level, on ontologically, we cannot make any distinction between this totality, plane of immanence, and its expression in and as and through us, or in and as the modes. So the modes and the substance and substance occupy the same same plane of immanence. The parts express the whole, and the whole exists only in its parts. This is going to be another consistent discussion of Deleuze's, this old philosophical question about what is the relationship between the parts and the whole. Well, Deleuze wants to try and dissolve this relation in the way that it's normally understood, and say that the part expresses the whole, and the whole only exists in its parts. This idea of the parts expressing the whole and the whole existing only in its expressions, this is emphasizing expression as the crucial element of Spinoza's system. And this is precisely how Deleuze reads it. So the large book on Spinoza is called Spinoza, Expressionism and Philosophy. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, the emphasis that Deleuze places on the attributes is precisely in order to enable this expressive relation between the modes and substance, that enables it to work. Deleuze argues expression is not simply manifestation, but is also the constitution of God himself. Life, that is expressivity, is carried into the absolute. Now, this engages with a whole kind of set of theological arguments about what is the relationship between God and the world, yeah, and manifestation is one possible relation, as is, oh, I've forgotten the name of it now, but those of you who maybe have read some Derrida will be familiar with this idea of the gift, and this is another classic theological relationship between God and the world, that God gives himself to the world, but that there remains a part of God that has to, let's say, pre-exist the world in order to give himself as the world. So again, this is another kind of theological model that maybe approaches immanence but doesn't quite go all the way. Deleuze discusses many of these models in the large book on Spinoza. We can see why this might be thought of as atheism, because it means that God nature, for Spinoza, has no existence outside of the becomings of its modal expressions. As Deleuze explains, this is the next quotation, what is involved is no longer the affirmation of a single substance, but rather the laying out of a common plane of immanence on which all bodies, all minds, and all individuals are situated. When God is nature, and therefore everywhere, and only everywhere, God as transcendent truth loses its place. So this is, again, a constant refrain of Deleuze's. He often uses this title of a very famous radio play by Antonin Artaud, to be done with the judgment of God. It means that if God is only everywhere, yeah, if God is only everywhere, then there is no position from which a morality or a judgment can actually be guaranteed. Yeah? So this is the Artaud phrase, to be done with the judgment of God. It means for Artaud to bring in the body without organs and so forth and so on. And we'll get to that later on. But in relationship to Spinoza, it's very important. Spinoza doesn't want to get rid of the concept of God. He can't get rid of the concept of God. It's not really thinkable in the 17th century. So he does the next best thing, which is to make God nature. Yeah, to completely place God into the world. God is everywhere and only everywhere. Okay, the modes express God nature. This is the next quotation. Whatever exists expresses the nature or essence of God in a certain and determinate way. That is, whatever exists expresses in a certain or determinate way the power of God, which is the cause of all things. Expression therefore becomes the defining process of all forms of life, both organic and inorganic, as well as being the realm of ethical action. The ethical question of how to live becomes the question of how to construct relations able to express the whole of God nature. This question is already an aesthetic question, because as aesthetics is the realm of affects for Deleuze, the realm of sensation. Any aesthetic experience will have an ethical dimension in being joyful or sad, and in increasing or decreasing my power to act. So we can extrapolate a little bit, and when we think that for Kant, the aesthetic realm, the realm of judgment, was constituted by the judgment, this is beautiful or this is sublime, and was recognized through a feeling, yeah? This feeling of pleasure or displeasure that Kant understood as a rise or fall in vital power. In Spinoza, it's a very similar idea, except that rather than the judgment, this is beautiful, it is replaced by a judgment or a feeling, joy or sadness. This causes me joy, this causes me sadness. And like in Kant, this gives a very specific kind of knowledge, yeah, but it is a knowledge that has been freed from, let's say, conceptual determination. In the case of Kant, but in the case of Spinoza, it has been freed from consciousness or imagination, as Spinoza also calls it, this inadequate form of knowledge. Any aesthetic experience, as a result, and as we will see when we come to Guattari, life is in fact an ethico-aesthetic paradigm, which is the partial title of Guattari's last book. To speak directly in terms of art, the question is not that of the relation of a subject or consciousness to an object, the artwork, which is simply an inadequate representation of this relation. The question instead is of the commonality between modes that allows them to compound their power in a new expression of the whole. This new expression is the becoming of the world by which God nature constructs and so understands itself. So, in terms of art, it means that the first and really only thing that has to be understood is the nature of the relation. When you are speaking about art, you are not speaking about anything else. Art, in this sense of an ethico-aesthetics, implies a process of material experimentation. This comes back to what we started with. If we do not know what the body can do, it is because our passions have hidden our essential power from us, our essence, and we will only reach adequate knowledge by exploring this unknown body. The more affects experienced by a body, the more ideas a mind can have. And when these ideas are adequate, we are able to understand our essence as an expression of God and not simply as our own. In this sense, art is a process of material experimentation that leads us beyond ourself, as this is determined by our consciousness and by our organic body. To understand affects as common notions means understanding relations as increases in power, which means understanding becoming as a process that takes us beyond the limits of the human. In this sense, and as Deleuze puts it, very nice little phrase, experimentation on oneself is our only identity. Experimentation on oneself is our only identity. This process of experimentation leads to an understanding of our essence beyond our organic body. In fact, it leads to the construction of a new body, one now defined by common notions. Deleuze explains, this is on the sheet of quotations, "He who has a body capable of a great many things has a mind whose greatest part is eternal." In other words, constructed by essences. The demonstration of this: he who has a body capable of doing a great many things is least troubled by evil effects, that is, by affects contrary to our nature. So he has the power of ordering and connecting the affections of his body according to the order of the intellect, consequently of bringing it about that all the affections of the body are related to the idea of God. It means that the more our body is capable of experiencing, the more our mind is able to understand our essential nature. The more we are able to understand our essential nature, the more we are able to understand God. Yeah? Leading to the third kind of knowledge or beatitude, where I understand myself in the same way that God understands itself. Yeah? This is the moment at which all of my ideas are eternal, because they are all concerning essential nature. Yeah? And this is also the moment at which I have, let's say, gone beyond any limits of myself that are imposed by my inadequate understanding, my imagination, my understanding of my experiences and my ideas as being affected, as being effects rather than causes. Yeah? So I've gone beyond myself to my eternal, essential nature, which is itself an expression, and I understand it as such, of everything that is. Yeah? This is this moment of eternity that Spinoza introduces at the very end of the Ethics, this final point of reason, this kind of ecstatic, mystical comprehension. This would be the final moment of thought, the moment when we are capable of thinking our own essence as an expression of God nature, and in so doing understand ourselves in the same way that God nature understands itself. This is a new image of thought, according to Deleuze, because it means that thought no longer transcends the body, making it a kind of avatar for the spirit in the Christian sense. This is the classic Platonic idea, right? That reason has to exactly get out of the body in order to find the essential ideas, the essential truth. Yeah? Whereas for Spinoza, it's exactly the opposite. It's only through the body that we're going to discover the eternal truths or essences. Deleuze puts it very clearly. This is, again, on the sheet of quotations. The body is no longer the obstacle that separates thought from itself, that which it has to overcome to reach thinking. It is, on the contrary, that which it plunges into or must plunge into in order to reach the unthought that is life. We do not even know what a body can do in its sleep, in its drunkenness, in its efforts and resistances. To think is to learn what a non-thinking body is capable of, its capacity, its postures. This is a quotation that comes from the Second Cinema book, where Spinoza also makes an appearance. And it's just another example of the way that this phrase, we do not even know what a body can do, is like a refrain that keeps on reoccurring and reappearing all throughout Deleuze's work. So when Deleuze says that this idea is Spinoza's war cry, we can say that in many senses it's Deleuze's as well. All right. So, if Deleuze claims that Spinoza introduces into philosophy a new image of thought, I think we can also say that Spinoza's ethical aesthetics introduces a new image of art, one that no longer understands art, at least when art is adequately understood, as a representational image. In place of the inadequate representational sign, Spinoza affirms the expressive affect. Art, in Spinoza's terms, will consist of constructing assemblages of joyful affects as expressions of nature's essences, and so, as such, it is an art of common notions rather than of representational signs. As a result, ethical aesthetics will not ask what an artwork means or represents, but asks what it is capable of expressing through its affects. In other words, ethical aesthetics is a question of what happens, a question of the process of composition, or of common notions which exist through and as the work. Once more, as with Nietzsche, this implies an art of living before it defines something that we might call art. This, of course, is kind of useful and also a problem in a way, because this is always the question we have in relationship to Deleuze and art. It's one that will carry on, I think, worrying us for the rest of the semester, which is that when we engage in these very philosophical discussions and debates surrounding ethics and ontology and so forth and so on, we do find new ways of approaching art, and quite radical transformations of understanding what art can actually be. In this sense, it's very generous. It means art is, in fact, you know, directly engaged in ontological and ethical processes, that art gives us direct access into the becoming of the world. It gives us direct access to these kinds of mystical enlightenments that can occur in the way that, like the eternal return or the third kind of knowledge. But there is the other side, which is the problem, which is that the further we go into these elements, the further we seem to leave what we would normally understand as being art. That we are further and further away somehow from discussing a painting or a sculpture or an artist. Yeah. Now, to a certain extent, Deleuze will answer many of these questions in the work that he does that is specifically concerning artwork. So, two books on cinema, a book on the painter Francis Bacon, and various other passages dotted all through the work that is directly about art. And we'll certainly be spending plenty of time when it comes to that. But in a way, this question that poses a kind of a problem that you have to decide for yourself. So, is art, let's say, truly philosophical in its scope? Yeah? In other words, can we give art a position of equivalence with ethics, with ontology, and so forth and so on? This is obviously what Deleuze wants to do. Yeah? In fact, to make it even a kind of, if not really the privileged form of politics, it's exactly the most problematic aspect of what Deleuze does, especially for people, as I said, like Bourdieu and so forth. Or are we to say, yeah, again, like these criticisms that are often made of Deleuze, it's a kind of romanticism. Yeah, it's a rerunning of the romantic privileging of art, and in the end, it doesn't give us a real firm grip on the politics of the everyday. Now, I just say that now not in order to give you an answer. I'm not even sure if I have an answer, because in the end, it does become a kind of question of taste. So, you know, of course, philosophy, like anything else, is a kind of an aesthetical question, right? So what is it that appeals to your taste? And not everything does, and it shouldn't be necessary that Deleuze does either. But hopefully, by the end of the course, you will have come to some kind of conclusion about that. All right, so the last quotation on the sheet is kind of emblematic in a way of what I'm talking about, this way in which art becomes kind of just a name for the most broadest kind of ontological processes. Deleuze says, "The common notions are an art, the art of the ethics itself, organizing good encounters, composing actual relations, forming powers, experimenting." All right, I think I'll leave it there for today. Any questions? Yes.
Do you know Umibaba?
Yes.
And what is the relation to Deleuze, Umibaba and Deleuze? Because for me there is some kind of resemblance in, for example, commitment to theory, Umibaba. Do you know that he writes about art or about culture and politics? And do you know something about the relation?
I'm not an expert on Homike Bhabha, but I have read him. I mean, my impression is that Bhabha is one of these theorists, so-called cultural studies people, that emerges, you know, from the 80s onwards, who are deeply influenced primarily by Derrida and Lacan, and in effect, it's an entirely different theoretical framework to Deleuze's. Most specifically, that they wish to understand cultural and aesthetic objects in relationship to a kind of linguistic conception. In other words, that cultural objects or aesthetic objects are signifiers that are related to each other through permanent relations of difference. Now, this might, on the surface of it, appeal similar to Deleuze, But the question is that this difference is understood in terms of a linguistic system. So in other words, a kind of structuralism that's founded on the linguistic theories of Ferdinand de Saussure, where a signifier takes on its meaning through a difference without positive terms. Okay, we won't get into it. But the point is that without knowing a huge amount about Barbar, I think that his project is somewhat different from Deleuze's in terms of the ontological assumptions of what he's doing are not the same. But how did you see them as being similar?
In this notion of hybridity, that something is not there a priori, how do you say, but in the moment of encounter, that it is the thing that it's not, it maybe says something about politics and about becoming. The idea of how politics could be structured or whatever.
Yes, but with Barbar there is no sense in which these hybridities or these encounters are expressions of a whole.
No, not in this way.
So this is on the level of ontology, where the concept of hybridity has a different value ontologically. So in other words, what is that hybridity? How do we understand that hybridity? What does it express? What is its relation to everything else? These are the ontological questions which would locate the hybridity in a broader philosophical system. This is where I think you would find the differences. Barbar is based on a different kind of philosophy.
I was not talking about the same difference of Fomi Barbar and Deleuze. I was just talking about the relation. How can there be a relation? Because if you want to maybe apply philosophy and politics, how can it be done? And I thought about a more practical way. If somebody's criticizing Deleuze because it can't be applied in a practical way, then I thought about Pablo, how he wants to do it, the politics by cultural emphasis.
Well, maybe I gave the wrong impression, because I'm certainly not suggesting that Deleuze can't be applied practically. Personally, I don't have that view. I just put that forward as being a criticism around it at the moment of Deleuze, but I would reject it as a real criticism. I think what I'm trying to emphasize, both with Nietzsche and with Spinoza, is that it's very, very practical. It's exactly about us. It's about our relations. Yeah. Does my relation cause me joy or cause me sadness? Yeah. What causes me joy and what causes me sadness? How can I understand my relations in order to be able to organize them so that I can have the maximum amount of joy, so that I can increase my power to act? Now, this is very practical, but it's not programmatic.
Yes.
Yeah? So, in other words, it's not giving a political program that, let's say, applies to everybody as to how this might take place. It's saying only that we can assess it on a case-by-case basis through the method of trial and error. So this is a sense in which it's both very, very practical, but also not, let's say, appealing to the normal criteria for a political theory. You had something.
Yes. Isn't it in the connotation you gave today, very simply said, just having fun with running against the wall of a kind of art? And isn't that quite far away from art?
Running against the wall?
Yeah, like a body impression, experience, and just for having fun of it?
Well, no. I mean,
very,
I'm sorry.
It's
you
very
don't,
simply said.
You don't have to read too much of Spinoza to understand that joy is not just like having fun. Okay, because he's like a real serious guy, and he's actually not really into having fun that much, right? And he says, you know, those guys who go out and they get drunk and they go to the ladies and all of that, that is not what I'm talking about, right? That's only going to get you in a bad way.
Okay.
So, all right, we know that anyway. But, so, I just want to make that clear, okay? It's a serious business, it's not
I didn't understand joy, right? So
okay.
I thought it was
joy is a serious business, and like it's connected to God, so
okay.
That should be enough to understand that it's serious. So the question is not just a kind of, as I mentioned before, this kind of, as some people call it, don't worry, be happy version of Spinoza, right? That's not really what we're talking about, okay? It's a kind of a serious experimentation which has this kind of very, this very, let's say, ambitious, yeah, philosophical / religious aim, which is to know God as God knows itself. Now, this is what I mean by, if we are to understand this as in terms of art, this is on one hand to give art the maximum extension, right? To be the most generous towards art that we possibly could be. To say, well, art can tell me, like, art can make me experience how I am an expression of everything.
It's not about self-experience, just in a way.
No, that's the opposite of self-experience. That's the experience of oneself, no longer as oneself, but as a living embodiment of the all. Yeah. So, in a way, this is the most kind of ambitious we could possibly be for art, right? But on the other, in trying to present kind of the other side or the other point of view, this is, according to, Bourdieu and people who follow him, on the one hand a very beautiful idea, but on the other a kind of hopeless romanticism. He means that not just in the kind of common sense of the word, but in the technical sense, that this is also what wrote German romanticism itself was very interested in, that, art expressed nature, and that through art we will be able to experience the kind of living wholeness of nature and so forth and so on. And this is an important question that, hopefully we can spend some time on, because it does involve, I think, a very important contemporary problem, which is how are we to act politically in the world? How are we to understand the world politically? This is clearly crucial. So, are we to understand the world politically, or can we understand the world politically in these terms, in these kinds of ethical, aesthetic terms? Yeah? Is this kind of experience, the transformation that this experience offers, is this an effective form of political action? Yeah? Or is this just a kind of, romantic aestheticization of life that kind of ignores the, practical questions of, of resistance and real revolution and, I don't know what. I mean, for Bourdieu, he's a Maoist, so these kinds of questions. So, I think, as I said before, you have to come to your own conclusions about this, and in many ways it does depend on a certain form of personal taste. So it depends on your own kind of sensibilities as to whether the Deleuzean line appeals or not. Yeah? But I emphasize these philosophical aspects because I do think that it is at least ironic that, at least within the contemporary art world, that many, many political concepts from Deleuze and Guattari are taken up and connected to contemporary art practice that would, let's say, attempt to be political in a fairly kind of straightforward sense. So, and it's exactly, this is exactly what I'm sort of working on most at the moment, which is to try and understand in a really properly rigorous way how it might be possible to understand contemporary art practices that regard themselves as being both conceptual and political, how it might really be possible to understand them in terms of Deleuze's philosophy of sensation or a politics of sensation, which is what he seems to argue. The thing is, it's like, I think that you have to accept that for Deleuze, an encounter with an artwork has as much, if not more, political value than a demonstration. Yeah? Because basically for Deleuze, anything that operates through discursive mechanisms is already tainted. It's already capitulated. Yeah? That you can't really use discursive mechanisms effectively, because by already adopting them, you have already accepted, you know, the structure of power. Yeah? And that's exactly what the possibility is that art offers, is a kind of an encounter, a kind of an experience, which is able to completely escape, or not completely escape, but which is able to escape these kinds of structures of power which already exist within language and within representation and so forth and so on. Yeah? So this is, as I said before, this is a very ambitious project to kind of give to art, if you like. Yeah, it's a lot of power to give to art. But from a political perspective, you might think, yeah, but that's ridiculous. You know, how can an encounter with an artwork have as much political value as a demonstration? Where's the politics in that? Yeah? Well, okay, that's the stake. That's what Deleuze and Guattari are offering. Yeah? Now, you can take it or not, it's up to you. But that's the... those are the stakes.
Is it all about visual art?
No. They actually say, in a very traditional way, that music is higher than visual art. So, it can be music too. What it always is, though, is not popular. It's not popular art. It's not populist art. It's very, very highbrow. I'll talk more about this later on in the semester, but it's always kind of avant-gardist art. It's always very, very high art. So we're talking about, you know, 12-tone compositional practices. We're talking about, you know, Boulez, Messiaen, so forth and so on, Stockhausen, you know, high, very highbrow musical tastes. And in terms of art, you know, the history of painting, more or less. So, and literature, of course, as well. It's also very, very important, yeah? American literature in particular, cinema. But again, with the cinema, it's the kind of, you know, art end, yeah? The European tradition, which is privileged. So these are also problematic elements in relationship to more contemporary tastes, yeah? Which want to see political art as being precisely the kind of art which is able to engage in media systems and new technologies and popular forms.
One of the architecture in its quite arty kind of expression, that would be a very beautiful to this time. It's political, it brings out things, it changes the way we live, things like that.
Well, that's an interesting point. Actually, it would be a great topic for an essay, but they don't talk very much about architecture. All right, well, we'll see you next week.